See. I don't want to share the computer audio anymore. Why won't Zoom let me stop sharing that? Ever since Zoom made me update, I like don't know my way around anything anymore.
Yeah, still did.
You did?
Yeah.
Okay. David fixed it. Praise God for David. Everyone said amen and hallelujah. Welcome, everyone. Hi, Sharon, Deborah. So good to see you. We didn't see you last time. Randy, hello, my love. Hello. Did that form work for you finally?
I think I had to try it one more time. It
Okay.
just I complete it and then I press like the ending button and then it just like glitches and wipes and then makes me start again. So I'm not sure if it's because it's like a Canadian to US thing. I don't know. It should be universal.
It should be. Yeah, I've gotten some responses from like Australia, so it should be. Let me see. I don't know. David, could you separately help Brandy with that issue, please? She's trying to fill out the survey and enter to win a coaching session. She can't fill it out. So, by the way, okay, Brandy, David will message you separately, get it figured out. By the way, everyone, while I'm thinking about it and we're waiting for more people to show up. Oh, good, Deborah, yay. That's okay. Hopefully, you caught the replay. Good, wonderful. Let me find my Google Drive really fast. And I will put in the chat if you have not yet filled out this survey that I've created. If you fill it out and you use your name and your email address, then you are entered in to win a private somatic listening session with me, which is worth $130 is what I normally charge for one session. So, if you fill that form out with your name and email, you will be entered in to win a somatic listening session. Yeah, Jen, fucking sign up for sure. Also, separately, speaking of signing up for coaching sessions, my one-on-one sessions that are like one-off that aren't part of a package are currently like 21% off, and like my calendar is pretty open for the summer, which is pretty usual. So I actually have more time to squeeze people in. Because normally my coaching calendar fills up in the fall as people are going back to school. People don't typically do this work a lot in the summer, which is also why our attendance goes down the further along we get in the summer. But it's fine. Thank you to those of you who are loyally here, even though I know you could be like at a pool or in the mountains or something like that. But yeah, the private coaching sessions with me are discounted. And so you could just buy like one or three or like however many you want. You don't have to commit to a package the way my normal clients have to. You don't have to apply to work with me the way normal clients have to. Like you just get to come and have a session. And hopefully you're really prepared with what you want to talk about so that we can maximize your hour. But those are on sale too. So, David, if you wouldn't mind putting a link to the chat to those in case anybody wants to book them. If you are in a time zone and I don't have an opening on the calendar during a time that works for your time zone, please let me know. We made an exception for someone who lived in Australia. I agreed to do an evening session with her. I don't normally work after 4, but I'm doing a 6:30 session with her because it's like 8 a.m. in Australia. So I'm willing to make that work if you do live somewhere where my time zone doesn't work for your time zone. Is there anything else that I need to talk about? Hello, Betsy. Hi, Marissa. Hello, Alexandria and Megan and Jen and Lenka. Yay! I'm so glad you're all here. Any questions before we get started about anything I just said or anything else? David just put the link to the coaching sessions. It just takes you straight to my calendar. You pick your day, you select it, you pay, you check out, you're done. You'll get an email with your confirmation. Any other questions or anything else we need to talk about before we get started? Is everyone caught up on replays? Hopefully. If you can turn your camera on, please do. If you can't, you don't have to, but I do love to see all of your faces. Okay, I'm just gonna get my computer fixed here. I would like to hide the toolbar. Thank you. Do you guys know that I'm like so technologically deficient that I don't even know how to make a PowerPoint, and all of my slideshows are literally just JPEGs that I created and save them in numerical order, and I just go through the file. That's how tech dumb I am. Megan's joining from the car. No surprises, Meg. Okay. I'm gonna close the chat. And are you guys ready to get started? All right, cool. Tonight's workshop is called Resilient. Okay, now I can see you all again. This is called Resilient. As usual, I will tell you more things about me in case I'm ever like famous one day and you're on Jeopardy and they ask a question about like her favorite food is buttered homemade pasta and ginger tea. And you'd be like, what is Lindsay Lockett or who is Lindsay Lockett? That's why I'm giving you all these trivia things. I'm just kidding. I like to know you guys, and so I like to share about myself. Today, I will tell you about places. My favorite place on this earth is my house. And my house is in the forest, which is also my favorite place. And I live like 4 miles from Lake Superior, which also happens to be one of my favorite places. And I only have to get in a plane ride, and it takes me about 9 hours to get to my final favorite place, which is Cozumel, Mexico. It's mine and David's favorite place on earth besides our house. And we usually try to go there twice a year if we can. One day, I would love to visit the Faroe Islands, the Scottish Highlands. I have a lot of Scottish Highlander ancestry, so I would love to go like drive through the Scottish Highlands and visit like little churches and records offices and look stuff up. And the Maldives, I would also love to go there. So, as you guys know, I'm not a licensed therapist, and this is not a substitute for your healthcare. I think you all know how to be responsible for your own healthcare choices at this point, but I have to say it anyway. And also, copyright laws, screenshot, tag me on Instagram if you share it, but otherwise, please don't use my stuff for any other reasons other than your own personal use, obviously. This tonight, I'm sorry, that should say fifth, not fourth. Man, I just made this slide before we started. This is the fifth workshop, not the fourth, in our series, and our group coaching call is on Tuesday, July 16th at 10 a.m. And our final time together is Just Live, Get Off the Trauma Healing Hamster Wheel. That's our final workshop. It's on July 31st at 5, and I see a typo on the group coaching call too. It's 8/6, not 8/16. Sorry. It said July 16 before. I just changed the 8 and forgot to change the 16 part. This is our final workshop, and it's all about taking everything that we've gone through together in Feel Without Fear and actually applying it to real life, and not real life being like doing the work all the time. Like actually just taking what you've learned and applying it in your life and in your relationships. I'm going to talk a lot about conscious communication in that workshop. We're going to talk a lot about the difference between fixing and support. Like there's an energetic difference there, and we're going to like feel into that a little bit so that you can catch yourself when you're in an energy of fixing. So it's a really applicable, practical workshop that kind of sums everything up and makes it sort of like, oh, here's what I do next, kind of. So that's on July 31st at 5 p.m. Central. So tonight we're going to start by answering the question, what is responsibility? So responsibility, the dictionary definition, is the state or fact of being responsible, answerable, or accountable for something within one's power, control, or management. Two, the ability to respond. That's more the definition that we're focusing on tonight, but still both. Other words for responsibility are authority, liability, power, trust, duty, and obligation. So, personal responsibility, what it is. Personal responsibility is you having awareness of your emotions and your nervous system state and your responses or reactions, owning how your choices and dysregulation have created your present reality, taking accountability and apologizing and repairing when necessary, using your agency to create these changes, setting boundaries with self and others to support your own well-being and the well-being of your relationships. Like, this is what you're responsible for. Okay. Especially emotionally speaking. Personal responsibility is not taking the blame for everything, making everything your fault or your problem to fix. Personal responsibility is not taking on other people's emotions and problems because you're a good friend or a good person. It's not hyper independence. It's not, I have to do everything myself or I can do everything myself. Those are not personal responsibility. Okay. Those are trauma responses. Those are not personal responsibility. So personal responsibility means you are taking ownership over what you can control. Knowing that you don't have control over everything, you are taking ownership of what you can control. You can control your behavior. You can control your reactions, your choices, and you can control how your emotions affect others. Obviously, you can't control if they take something personally or if they're triggered and you don't mean to trigger them. But what I'm saying is, like, if you're yelling at someone and they react to that in a like fearful way or they yell back, like, you are still responsible for not yelling. That's what that means. Personal responsibility means you admit when you've made a mistake and you attempt to correct it. It's okay to say you wish you had done something differently. It means you acknowledge others' feelings without making yourself responsible for how others feel. Unless, of course, you have acted in a way, you know, that's out of integrity. If I yell at my kids, of course, I am going to hold myself responsible for their feeling hurt because they are hurt because I yelled at them. So I have to hold myself responsible. I mean, I would be responsible for their feelings in that instance. If it were an instance where I inadvertently triggered someone or I said something offensive and didn't realize that I did, it poked the wrong person's buttons. Instead of getting defensive of that, I can acknowledge, oh yeah, I totally see how you feel. That makes sense. And I'm sorry I did that, but I am not making myself responsible for their feelings. I'm just responsible for not knowing what I didn't know, I guess, and making it right, or at least acknowledging and validating their feelings. Personal responsibility also means you take accountability and attempt to repair when you've had a part in ruptures. Personal responsibility isn't just about how you're responsible to show up around others. You also have a responsibility to yourself. You have a responsibility to be authentic. Anything other than your authenticity is dishonest to yourself and to your relationships. You have a responsibility to yourself to be in awareness. That's where it all starts. You have a responsibility to support your body, your mind, and your spirit, doing your basics, your self-care, eating nourishing food, moving in gentle ways, drinking water, going outside, getting fresh air, sunshine, prioritizing your sleep, fueling your spiritual life, having some sort of spiritual practice, whether it's oracle cards or praying or meditating or meditative walks or yoga or whatever it is, something that feeds your spiritual mind. You are responsible for keeping yourself supported in those ways. You also have a responsibility to yourself to live with purpose and intention. You came onto this planet at this time in this lifetime to have a purpose. Like, you're here for a purpose. And maybe you already feel like you're living in your purpose. Maybe you don't feel like you're living in your purpose. Purpose isn't really something that you have to find. It kind of finds you. You know, but you have to be open to it. And there has to be space in your life for it to come in or for you to figure out what it is. So you do have a responsibility to live in that purpose because that's what you came here to do. And finally, you have a responsibility to love and trust yourself. Of course, I think that goes without saying, but I'll say it anyway. You cannot take responsibility for other people, not their reactions, not their feelings, not their choices, not their happiness, not their mistakes, and not their words. Obviously, if you're a parent, some of this is different. Like, if you have little kids, I'm mostly talking about relating to adults with this. Obviously, I do think parents, to a certain extent, are responsible for their kids' choices and their kids' reactions and definitely their kids' feelings. So I'm mostly talking about relating to other adults. Gabor Mate, in his book, In the Realm of Hungry Ghosts, said, "We may not be responsible for another's addiction or the life history that preceded it, but many painful situations could be avoided if we recognized that we are responsible for the way we ourselves enter into the interaction. And that, to put it most simply, means dealing with our own stuff." I love that quote so much. And then from the book Codependent No More, Melody Beattie says, "Self-care is an attitude toward ourselves and our lives that says, I am responsible for myself." She also says, "Self-care is an attitude of mutual respect. It means learning to live our lives responsibly. It means allowing others to live their lives as they choose, as long as they don't interfere with our decisions to live as we choose. Taking care of ourselves is not selfish, as some people assume it is, but neither is it as selfless as many codependents believe. A codependent person is one who has let another person's behavior affect him or her, and who is obsessed with controlling that person's behavior. The heart of the definition and recovery lies not in the other person, no matter how much we believe it does. It lies in ourselves, in the ways we have let other people's behavior affect us, and in the ways we try to affect them. The obsessing, the controlling, the obsessive helping, caretaking, low self-worth bordering on self-hatred, self-repression, an abundance of anger and guilt, peculiar dependency on peculiar people, attraction to and tolerance for the bizarre, other-centeredness that results in self-abandonment, communication problems, intimacy problems, and an ongoing whirlwind trip through the five-stage grief process." Does everyone know the five-stage grief process? Hopefully. Okay, everyone's shaking their heads. Great. So we're all codependent in some way, like all of us. It's just human nature. David and I are codependent, and I think we have a really conscious relationship. We recognize that the nature of our intimate relationship means that logically we can't make each other feel anything, but emotionally, the nature of our intimacy means we are affected by each other in very real ways. And there's no getting around that with anyone you live with. There's no way of getting around that. I don't care how much Alcoholics Anonymous tells you differently. No way around it. So this comes up in our triggers, which we lovingly and patiently work on inside the safe container of our relationship. And ultimately, we are striving for interdependence. We're not trying to be 100% independent of each other. And we're not trying to be 100% like glued together, codependent, can't be, you know, our full selves without each other kind of person. But still, I cannot be responsible for David's happiness, nor can he be responsible for mine. So if despite all of my efforts, my communication, my boundaries, my expression of my feelings, desires, and needs, if David is unable to meet me in a way that feels authentic to him, he is responsible to tell me that. Just as much as I am responsible to put effort, communication, boundaries, et cetera, into the relationship and vice versa. So we're not making each other responsible for our feelings, but we're also saying, I'm going to be open to you about my needs. I'm going to be open with you about my feelings. I'm going to be raw and transparent about what's going on for me and tell you what I want and tell you what I need. If you are not able to meet that in a way that feels authentic, then you have to tell me that, because it's unfair to both of us for me to hear you say, oh yeah, I can do that. So now I have the expectation that you're going to do that. And it's unfair for you to put that on yourself if you know you can't. So it makes us have to be radically honest with each other, and we can't sugarcoat things or hide things or shove things under the rug, because ultimately that just leads to resentment, which will lead to a bigger conflict down the road. And this is for all of our emotionally intimate relationships. This doesn't just apply to husband and wife or partners. This applies to adult relationships, certainly, but especially people who you really want to build closeness with. We are hurt in relationship, every single one of us. The reason that you're here in this group is because you were hurt in a relationship, whether it was a parent relationship, a child relationship, a sibling relationship, a teacher relationship. Like, you were hurt inside of some relationship. And so we have to heal in relationship. We need these disconfirming experiences. So I strongly encourage you to establish safe, committed relationships. They don't have to be sexual or romantic. My best friend, Honor, I refer to her as my platonic life partner. We've never kissed. We've never done anything sexual. We've hugged and we've held hands, and that's literally it. But we are committed to each other. Like, we have verbally said, like, I'm in this for the long haul, dude. I'm going to work this shit out with you no matter what. She's the second closest person to me besides David. And I have about three other people in my life who we have that same level of intimacy. And we also have that same level of, you know, radical self-responsibility, transparency in our communication, being honest if we can't meet those needs with, for the other person. These relationships are containers where we get to work through stuff like this, and it ends up healing each other. There's nothing that heals in me that doesn't heal in someone else whenever we repair a rupture, because we all have abandonment issues. And so whenever we stay through a rupture, that tells both of our nervous systems, like, hey, this is different. This isn't like that other relationship that hurt you so much, that's kept you on guard this whole time. This one is different. This person stays even if things are hard and they don't abandon us. And that is a really, really powerful thing to experience. And it's so healing. I don't believe that we have to remove all codependency from our relationships to heal patterns. I don't believe that at all. I think that every relationship gets to decide what level of codependency feels right for them. And certainly books and resources can be helpful in determining what that is, but like, ultimately every relationship has their own dynamic. So every relationship is going to have a different degree of codependency. I think that codependency, at least what I've noticed in my own relationships, is that codependency naturally decreases over time as each person is responsible for being aware of themselves, regulating their own nervous system, communicating in healthy ways, and being authentic. It's like, we don't even really have to use the word codependent or let's work on our codependence. It's like, no, how can we create a relationship where we don't need the codependency patterns because there's so much more safety present? Does that make sense? Hopefully. So still, when it comes to codependency, one common pattern is something called false responsibility. So false responsibility is when we take responsibility for things that are not ours to take responsibility for. So that could be something like apologizing for something when you did nothing wrong. I think everyone has that person in their lives, or some of you may be that person in your life where, like, no matter what they do, it's like, oh, I'm sorry. Oh, sorry. Oh, sorry. Like, they're just like the sorry people, and they're sorry for like breathing and taking up space, and they're like apologizing all the time. So that's one example of false responsibility. Another example would be like apologizing for someone else who refused to apologize. Sometimes couples do this, like the husband, whether the wife will apologize for the husband's behavior, or the husband will apologize for the wife's behavior. And this can also include taking responsibility for an adult child who is capable of being responsible for themselves, but refuses to, or deals with addiction or other mental health issues, nervous system dysregulation. At a certain point, we have to let our adult kids like start to figure this kind of stuff out for themselves and start their own healing journey, because everyone has one, right? And some of us didn't get into it until we were in our 30s. Some of us even later, but, everybody, I think, has that journey at some point to some degree. So our kids, our adult kids, need to be released in order to have that journey for themselves. So we as the parents can't keep taking responsibility for them and bailing them out of trouble. We have to let them fail and make mistakes, because that's how ultimately all of us figured out how to be adults, right? I feel like I could teach an entire workshop on codependence and false responsibility, but essentially what I'm trying to say is it's your responsibility to know what's yours and what isn't yours. And if you ever don't know what's yours and what isn't yours, communicate that. Like, it's okay to say, I'm not actually sure what I'm responsible for here. Like, that's really okay to say. It may take some time to figure that out, but having awareness of where that's showing up will definitely speed that process. So being responsible for our reactions also means that we're responsible for what we do or say when we get triggered, when we are outside of our window of tolerance. Even if we do something completely unintentionally, those actions can have consequences, and we're still responsible for those, for how we react. So your triggers are your responsibility. My triggers are my responsibility. No one else can be responsible for what triggers us. We have an opportunity to face and heal a trigger every single time we get triggered. It's like the universe hits the rewind button and plays it again. Rewind, play again, rewind, play again. It's like, here you go. Here's another chance. Here's another chance. I think it's pretty merciful that way. And whether you react in ego or fear or judgment, or you lean into that discomfort and you heal it, or you get closer to healing it, is totally your choice. It's completely up to you. It's okay to let others know about your triggers if it's relevant to the relationship and ask that they avoid that around you. People are always allowed to say no. They can accommodate your request if they choose, but they're not required to. And they're not bad if they don't accommodate you. Again, like what you're asking as an accommodation may be outside of their authenticity. And so if it is outside their authenticity and you get upset about that because they're not accommodating you, then what you're essentially saying is, I actually want you to people please me, which destroys trust in a relationship. So this is like one of those tricky balance things that we have to navigate in relationships sometimes is like, if something triggers me, how much am I able to tolerate before I have to do something about getting myself out versus making other people have to accommodate me? Like, that's a constant moving target, I feel like. And I feel like collectively in the world, we're having a lot of these conversations, even about like, where's the line between where I have to accommodate this person versus where I get to exist in my own sovereignty? Like, that's a really common thing that we're navigating in all kinds of places, right? Medical stuff, racism stuff, political stuff, educational stuff. You know, it's always like, how much space am I allowed to take up and how much can others take up before they start intruding on my space? And we're certainly doing that on the micro level in our relationships. So other people in our relationships have a responsibility to themselves to be authentic, just as you have a responsibility to yourself to be authentic. And your needs and accommodations can't interfere with other people's authenticity. And I think what we often think is that if someone can't handle our needs or our boundaries or our accommodations or whatever, then that makes them selfish, or that means they don't care about us, or it means, you know, they're harmful or problematic or whatever word you want to use. And certainly, people do have the capability of being selfish. Like, and I think people are allowed to be selfish. I don't think selfishness is always bad. But I don't believe that selfishness is always authentic either. And I think sometimes when we sit with, like, how much do I have to give here? If we're in a place in our lives where we actually have quite a lot of capacity, we're feeling really good, quite a lot of flexibility, we may actually be able to give more during those times than we can during times whenever we don't have as much capacity or flexibility or resiliency. So, very complex and very nuanced. I hope you guys are like making space for all of the different little complexities of this. So, obviously, if you have a disability and you need to be in need accommodations for a wheelchair, a walker, sign language, a hearing aid, you have an anaphylactic allergy, like those things are reasonable accommodations to expect. But it's way outside the scope of this workshop to talk about like various levels of neurodivergence or autism that may require accommodation and other things. Like I was saying, we're all kind of in this weird space of like, how much can I accommodate before it feels like I'm people pleasing or doing stuff out of obligation? And it's a really, it's like feeling like a tightrope sometimes, honestly. It's like, ooh, the lines are so rigid. I don't know. My good girl programming kicks in with all of that too, because then I start feeling bad. And then I'm like, but I want to take up space too. And like, I kind of have this internal battle inside myself when it comes to this kind of stuff. So it's really, really complex. But since I mentioned it, I do want to talk briefly about adaptations to trauma like neurodivergence, complex PTSD, and ADHD. Because especially for this class, complex PTSD is so relevant. That's essentially what this was created for. But I know that neurodivergence, complex PTSD, ADHD, and autism also kind of like oftentimes we find them all existing together. And I myself have the question all the time, like, is it chicken or the egg? Like, what existed first? Was I actually born neurodivergent? And did that make me more sensitive to trauma? Or did I experience trauma and the resiliency in my body went down, 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 and then I started showing signs of autism, ADHD, and neurodivergence? I don't know which one happened first. I don't know. I just know that they all seem to be really, really related. So there is overwhelming evidence that complex PTSD, ADHD, autism, and neurodivergence are caused by chronic emotional trauma. These are adaptations of a chronically dysregulated nervous system. They are symptoms. They are not diseases. I don't believe that they are disorders either. So research shows, we know this from other workshops, that trauma changes the size and connectivity of certain areas of the brain. Trauma enlarges the amygdala so that non-threatening things are perceived as threatening. And the hippocampus is smaller and less active in traumatized people, which can cause difficulty with memory and problem solving. We are learning more about how people exposed to trauma learn to distinguish between what is safe and what is not. Their brain is giving us insight into what might be going awry in specific mechanisms that are impacted by trauma exposure, especially when emotion is involved. So, when emotion, this is from the Institute for Neuroscience at the University of Rochester. So, I basically took a study and distilled it down to like tiny talking points because it was really long. But you can look this up if you want to. When emotion was evoked by a threat, people with PTSD could not complete tasks in the same way that non-traumatized people could complete tasks with emotion involved. The possibility of threat can change how someone exposed to trauma reacts. Triggers. And PTSD is driven by remarkable dysfunction in brain areas vital to fear processing and response. So basically, I'm saying that I know your brain is changed by what happened to you, and that's not your fault. We need to have grace and compassion for ourselves and others. But to the extent that you can heal your brain and nervous system through awareness, feeling, embodiment, healthy coping skills, meeting your basic needs, you can begin to unlearn some of those adaptations gone awry. These adaptations once served you by helping you tolerate otherwise unbearable circumstances. If they negatively affect your relationships with others and self now, it's worth getting curious and asking yourself how, where, and what you could choose to start shifting those patterns. That is your responsibility in a relationship. So if you can help others out by sharing what you know about yourself and how it could affect them, that is an acceptable level of personal responsibility. You are also allowed to ask for reasonable accommodations from others, and that is a way to fulfill your personal responsibility to yourself. Part of personal responsibility is also the understanding that others are allowed to say no to your requests and to your behaviors. They should be free to exercise their own agency without being called ableist or discriminating, without being accused of, gaslighting or being a narcissist, if that's not what's actually happening. Like all those insults that we hurl at each other often are because we don't like someone else's free will that they're using their own agency to exercise. So I am speaking as someone with a lot of lived experience with trauma's effects on my brain and subsequently my entire life. How I think, feel, engage socially, interpret communication cues, perform my tasks, and more. I have diagnosed conditions like generalized anxiety disorder, major depressive disorder without psychosis, and PTSD that do create very real challenges for me in my life. And I have also diagnosed myself with complex PTSD and ADHD. So I'm not speaking from an ignorant place at all. Let's hold the complexity. This one, if you can tell, is really full of a lot of complexity. It's going to like stretch and pull your brain, and it may be in uncomfortable ways. I'm kind of hoping that it will be, but that'll activate some neuroplasticity to start rewiring your brain. So it'll be great. I need to change this slide from I can have challenges to I do have challenges. Part of me accepting more of myself is realizing that I may not get over some of my challenges. Like, I may hit a plateau where I don't like get further than that in this lifetime, because of what I've experienced in my life and the real damage that I know it's done to my mind and body. And as much as I've tried to reverse a lot of that and, nourish myself and repattern my behaviors and things like that to take really good care of myself, like I have no type of expectation that there's ever going to be a point where it's like, oh, finally, I can read social cues perfectly and I never misinterpret anybody's tone. Like I'm not of that hope or expectation at all. So I need to change this slide to say I do have challenges that make relationships and work difficult for me. And also, I have developed some conscious and some unconscious adaptations in reaction to these challenges. And also, those adaptations often create problems in my relationships that make it hard to communicate, to give and receive intimacy, to experience pleasure, to interpret nonverbal cues, and to deal with emotions. Okay, get ready. We're getting more complex. And also, many of my adaptations were not my choice, but they were necessary for survival. And also, they still affect people I love in very real ways, ways that could possibly hurt them or harm them or create a lack of safety in the relationship, which I definitely care about. And also, I'm capable of noticing myself and allowing others' feelings about how they're affected by me. And also, sometimes I feel defensive about how I am, and I can go into victim consciousness of it not being my fault, and others need to accommodate me and remember my sensitivities to things. And also, that's an unreasonable thing to expect because it is my responsibility to meet my needs and set my boundaries in relationships and also not hold others responsible for my shit. I could keep going. And this is just one challenge that I face in terms of communication and recognizing how that affects other people. And also, it's so complex. It requires so much curiosity and willingness to ask questions and communicate. Show of hands or raise your hand if your camera's on. How many of you have actually broken down some of your triggers or your reactions or your challenges to that level to see this is how it affects me, and also this is how it affects them, and also here's how I communicate it, and also here's how I don't communicate it, and Deborah's saying she has, Brandy, you have, amazing, Shannon has, Sharon has, sorry, not Shannon, sorry, slip. Anybody else? Guys in the chat? I guess I could look in the chat. I need to do my and alsos. That's okay, Meg. Link is inspired. Yeah, Sharon's saying it's a bit of a mind fuck. Yep, Jen's still learning. That's okay. That's okay. Y'all are great. I'm just showing you this is how complex it is. And I mean, all of this I became aware of literally through the practice of awareness and curiosity. Like being able to notice, oh, I'm having a feeling about something. And also I notice that the person I'm talking to is having a feeling. And I feel like I want to get defensive and reactive and I want to yell, but I know that that's only going to contribute to the problem. So instead, I'm going to try to calm myself down and then ask them, what's going on for you? And then I'll hear their response, and that might totally change my state because their response might not be what I was projecting that it might be. It really requires slowing down situations and conversations, being very aware of your words, of your tone, asking questions if there's something that maybe you misinterpret. This is something I do a lot. I misinterpret tone all the time. My daughter and I had an argument. Well, it was not really an argument. We had a firm conversation yesterday. I won't call it an argument. We had a firm conversation yesterday because for the last week, there have been three or four separate instances where she has spoken to me in a tone that to me sounds like she's annoyed with me. And so last night I was like, she did it again. And I was like, okay, honey, I gotta talk to you about this. You did this the other day when we were on our way to get ice cream. You did this the other day when we were standing in the bathroom. You're doing this now. You're speaking to me in this annoyed voice. Have I done something that's really annoying you? And maybe you're just not telling me directly? And she was like, no, I don't think so. And I was like, well, the way that your tone is coming across sounds like you're really annoyed at me, and I'm confused because you haven't told me that I've done anything to annoy you. And I don't know if that's because you don't think you can, or you're afraid to, or you don't want to hurt my feelings, but I would much rather you tell me if I've done something to annoy you than indirectly tell me with your tone, because I could be misinterpreting this, or I might not be, but I don't know because you're not directly telling me. And she was like, "Well, I don't feel annoyed, but I agree, my tone did sound annoyed just now." And I was like, "Okay, thank you for acknowledging that. Are you annoyed with me elsewhere?" And she was like, "I don't really think so. I mean, my period was coming up, so maybe I was just kind of pissy or something." And I was like, "Okay, that's totally fine. That makes sense. That happens to me too. Like, I totally understand." And also, when we know we're about to start our periods and we know we're cranky and irritable, like, we still have a responsibility not to hurt other people's feelings. So if that means you need space from us, or if that means that you need to tell us, like, "Hey, you guys, I'm feeling really irritable. If I come across as irritable today, please don't take it personally, but you're also allowed to tell me it bothers you." Like, this is the conversation me and my kid were having last night. Like, it's way deeper than, "Don't talk to me like that." You see, way, way more than that. It ended up being educational for her to learn better communication skills. It was a great opportunity for me to relate to her as an adult instead of as a kid, because she'll be 19 next week. So, like, instead of lecturing her or telling her what to do, it was more of an opportunity for me to be like, "Hey, we are both adults who cohabitate in this space, and like, when you talk to me this way, it hurts my feelings. Not, you're my kid, you're not allowed to talk to me that way." Anyway, lots of complexity, requires so much curiosity. It requires learning and honing and refining your communication skills and being able to ask a lot of questions, curious questions, not judgmental questions. Ultimately, I believe that we each have a responsibility to reduce harm. The harm that we cause ourselves through self-abandonment, and the harm we call others with our unconscious coping mechanisms, or what Dr. Mate refers to as a trait becoming a state. I have caused very real harm to people because of acting outside of my integrity and out of my awareness due to trauma responses. We all have. And that's not a fun thing to acknowledge or admit. There, it may bring up a lot of guilt or a lot of shame. Like, there's certainly space for that. I believe that guilt and shame have a beautiful way of showing us, like, "Hey, you did this thing and it didn't feel good. And it caused some harm to people that you really, really love. And like, that makes you not want to do that thing anymore." You know, it actually can serve a really lovely purpose. It's not fun to experience for sure. So the safest relationships are the ones where each person, as much as is possible, is aware of themselves. And where they are not aware, because we're all blind to our own stuff, they are open to trusted feedback for how they can be a safer place for the other. So let's talk about harm reduction. If we are not in awareness of our patterns, our behaviors, our coping mechanisms, our triggers, our traumas, our complex PTSD, and however that shows up for us, we will unconsciously cause hurt and harm to others. This is not because we are bad people. I do not believe any of us is inherently bad. It's because nervous system dysregulation that is not met with awareness and conscious response, which is responsibility, has the potential to hurt and harm other people. Hurt and harm were done to each one of us by people who probably did not have awareness of generational patterns, their own dysregulation, their own inner critic, their parts. We did not choose this. So 100%, it's not fucking fair. Like, of course it's not fair. But when we don't take responsibility for how the harm done to us is being repeated by us onto others, we're not able to reduce harm. We're not stopping generational trauma. It's just perpetuating and perpetuating. So now I want to talk about unintegrated emotions and harm after I take a drink. First, we're going to do a quick review of our nervous system states. Remember last time I told you guys that I wanted you to have polyvagal theory memorized so that you could like see it in your sleep. So we're going to review that. Here's our ladder. If you were not here last time and you haven't seen the replay, I'm essentially breaking down the activation part of the ladder. And every nervous system state has a primary emotion. So the primary emotion of the fight state is anger. The primary emotion of the flight state is perseverance. It gives us the energy to get through something or the energy we need to run a long, far distance away from something. The primary emotion of freeze is judgment, and the primary emotion of shutdown is shame. So, as a reminder, nervous system dysregulation is normal. Getting outside your window of tolerance is normal. The goal is not, I want to heal so much that I'm never dysregulated again, or I want to have such a regulated nervous system that I never hurt anyone ever again. That's not realistic. Dysregulation is our body's protective mechanism. It's what tells us to fight back or get the fuck out or freeze and play dead. It's necessary. It's necessary. It's necessary. And also, chronic dysregulation or frequently becoming hyper or hypoaroused, meaning very far outside your window of tolerance, are indicators that that emotion is not integrated. Meaning, when that emotion comes in, it's a big, fast energy, and you don't know what the fuck to do with it. You don't know how to be a channeler of that emotion versus collapsing around it and being reactive. Unintegrated emotions often result in unconscious reactions, which can seriously hurt self and others. So, our sympathetic activation, this is the nervous system state of fight, the energy or the energy in motion, emotion is anger. So when you're just outside your window of tolerance, you're feeling just a little dysregulated, that's where irritability, frustration, controlling, bullying, being condescending kind of comes in. When you get way blown outside your window of tolerance, you are hyper aroused. This is where we see those unintegrated fight responses. So chaotic emotional responses, aggression, rage, violence, abuse, getting out of control, being demanding, threatening. When we know how to catch that energy of anger and channel it through our bodies in service of asserting ourselves, getting stuff done, having motivation, drive, setting boundaries, then our fight is integrated. We know how to handle anger without taking that hot potato of anger and throwing it at somebody else and hurting them with it. In relationships, the energy of anger lets us know when our boundaries have been crossed and when we might need to step in to protect and defend another or ourselves. When it's not integrated and not met with awareness, the energy of anger is outside our window of tolerance. We are unable to hold that energy without hurting ourselves or others. It's like a hot potato that we'll throw at somebody because we can't hold it. When we have unintegrated anger and judgment about anger, we also can't hold the charge of anger, so we collapse. Collapse happens because we repress, we stop, we silence, we judge our own anger. If anger can't be discharged in service of bringing us back to safety through self-defense, the defense of others, setting boundaries, whatever, we will collapse into immobilization. You are closer to safety when you are angry than you are when you are shut down. If you can't discharge that anger energy to push you up into safety, then that energy has nowhere to go and you collapse. When you are able to hold the charge and channel the energy of anger, you can assert yourself calmly and firmly. You can set and hold boundaries without being rigid, meaning you know when it's necessary to be more rigid, when you can be more lax. The energy gives you courage and motivation, and you can be in grounded and regulated leadership. So here's how unintegrated anger can harm other people. When our kids are met with yelling or threats of punishment more often than not. When our partners, spouses, and friends are met with yelling. When our emotional outbursts are chaotic and cause fear and confusion for others. When we are demanding or controlling of others. And when we can't hold our hot potato and not throw it onto others. When we repress our anger and it stays stuck in our bodies, that leads to collapse and shame. That is harming of self. When we collapse and then are unable to set boundaries or stand up for ourselves, that is harming of self. How might your unintegrated relationship with anger be harming you? And how might it be harming people that you love? It's a very radical, honest question to ask oneself. Now we will talk about flight. The energy of flight is perseverance. In a dysregulated state, you're like stuck in the on position, you're kind of a worry wart, hypervigilant, constant busyness, multitasking, perfectionism. When that flight response is really, really big, there's chaotic emotional outbursts, anxiety, overwhelm, OCD, you're really, really rigid, you're rushing around, panicking, experiencing really bad sleep issues. If you can meet that flight response or that anxiety energy with awareness, it gives you what you need for calm determination, knowing when to retreat or disengage from conflict, being in grounded productivity instead of, running around like a chicken with your head cut off with, 25 unfinished projects. Your productivity is grounded and steady, a sense of industriousness, and you're able to get stuff done. In relationships, the energy of perseverance gives us what we need to stick it out through hard times and conflict and to invest the time and energy needed to repair ruptures. If you're going to be in a long-term relationship, whether it's romantic or not, it's going to require a lifetime of perseverance. So that flight energy really, really serves us. When it's not integrated and not met with awareness, the energy of perseverance basically becomes the energy of anxiety or panic. It's outside of our window of tolerance. And we can't hold its energy without going into flighty states of busyness or ungrounded productivity. We can't turn off when we need to. And when we can't hold and integrate that anxiety energy into perseverance, we can hurt others with obsessive compulsiveness, being too rigid, or throwing your hot potato of anxiety onto them, basically meaning you're making everybody else responsible for your anxiety. When we have unintegrated perseverance and judgment about productivity, we collapse. We collapse because we repress our agency to choose slowness and calm determination. If flight energy and unintegrated perseverance cannot be discharged in service of bringing us back to safety through healthy retreat from danger or using calm determination to stick with something, we will collapse into immobilization. Again, you are closer to safety when you're in a flight state than you are when you're in a collapse state. And if that flight energy has nowhere to go to get you to safety, you're gonna collapse around it. When you can hold the charge and channel the energy of perseverance, you know when to disengage from conflict that's dangerous or going nowhere or going in a circle. You have a spirit of industriousness. There's a calm confidence in your ability to get things done. There's a sense of groundedness in your productivity, and you're able to notice and tend to details without becoming overwhelmed. The energy of perseverance gives us what we need to see, get through challenges and see them to completion. When not met with awareness, a dysregulated or hyper-aroused flight state, and the energy of perseverance is outside your window of tolerance. And because you can't hold the charge without hypervigilance, controlling, anxiety, micromanaging, it devolves into anxiety and panic when it's really severe. So here's how unintegrated perseverance can harm other people. When we don't allow others to rest because we expect the same constant productivity and output of them as we do of ourselves. If A pattern that I see with a lot of women is when their partners are sitting on the couch watching a sport or on their phones or playing a video game or something like that, and the wife, the woman in the relationship is taking care of kids, doing the dishes, folding the laundry, packing lunches, like all of that, she starts to get resentful and angry at her spouse. And I'm not saying that men don't need to parents and help around the house in the same way as women. They absolutely do. But what women often do is instead of saying exactly what they want and what they need, is they get angry and resentful at the husband. And it's because the husband knows how to rest. He knows how to unplug from life and give himself downtime. And she wants the same for herself, but she won't allow herself to have it. She won't allow herself to have it because she won't have a conversation with her husband that says, "Hey, I need you to be an equal partner in this relationship. And you're just as capable of packing lunches as I am. You're just as capable of folding laundry as I am. You're just as capable of bathing these kids as I am." Like, and then we can both rest together, right? Like, that would be clear, straightforward communication versus that unintegrated perseverance, making her continue to work while she sits and resents and stews over her partner who's watching football. It's such a cliche example because it's so fucking common, but I use it because it's so common. Like, yes, the dude can turn off the game or record the game and go help his wife, but also, is the wife saying what she needs and wants? And certainly, there are relationships where one or both of them is going to continue being toxic, and he's never going to get up and help, and she's never going to communicate what she needs. But I'm not talking about unconscious relationships. I'm talking about conscious relationships. I hope that that is very, very clear. Another way that our unintegrated perseverance can harm others is when we have a short fuse and emotional outburst with our kids, our friends, and our partners. When our anxiety leaks onto other people, either making them anxious or making them responsible for reducing our anxiety. And when we put standards of perfectionism on other people. Anxious people put standards of perfectionism on other people. Anxious mothers raise perfectionistic daughters. Okay. I hope we all know that. And here's how unintegrated perseverance can harm us personally when we don't allow ourselves rest because of the urge to be constantly productive, when we place standards of perfectionism on ourselves, when we micromanage and control our bodies, our health, our environments, etc. When we are rigid and our bodies can't relax and release tension, and when we rush and go constantly. Now we're in the state of freeze. This is a combination state. So, freeze is a secondary state, meaning that two primary neural pathways are active at the same time. The primary pathway of sympathetic activation, which is the GAS, combined with the primary pathway of the dorsal vagal activation, which is shutdown, or the brakes, creates the state of freeze. The primary energy of freeze is judgment. When dysregulated, that feels like guilt, anxiety, procrastination, gas in the brakes going at the same time, shooting all over yourself, wanting or knowing you need to do something, but like not being able to start or not being able to move. When it's unintegrated, that looks like panic attacks, extreme anxiety, agoraphobia, codependency, suicidality, overwhelm, burnout, stuck. That's what that looks like. And then when integrated, freeze is the perfect state to allow us to pause, to weigh all of our options, to take as much time as we need to make a grounded decision, to have discernment, to be judicious, to notice our intuitive resistance to something, to have a state of poised readiness and acute awareness, meaning I'm aware of what's going on around me. I'm not in action, but I'm ready to be in action if I need to be. In relationships, the energy of judgment serves to give us discernment and judiciousness. We have to slow down to carefully weigh our options and feel into what is right for us and the relationship. We have to slow down to learn to communicate better. We have to slow down to learn to hold the complexities and different perspectives of every situation. Requires slowness. When it's not integrated and not met with awareness, judgment is outside our windows of tolerance. If you are in a chronic freeze state, you are in a state of unintegrated judgment. You're stuck in between a rock and a hard place. You get overwhelmed, you get stuck. There is an anxiousness in the waiting that you can't tolerate. When we have unintegrated judgment and we're stuck between options, it's like, what should I do? What should I choose? I should do this. I should do that. Everything is the wrong decision and everything is the right decision, and you don't know which to pick. We stay in this state of exhausted anxiety, like tired but wired, and that quickly depletes our energetic resources and it leads to overwhelm and burnout. If judgment can't be mobilized so that a decision or a move can be made, then we're likely to stay in this sort of frozen gas break state before eventually collapsing into shutdown or the feeling of I can't, big shame, I couldn't do it, whatever. But that's because the body can't maintain that gas break state for a long time. Like, it's going to lead to just straight breaks eventually, so that your body can recover those energetic resources. When you are able to hold the charge and channel the energy of judgment, that's when you can pause to weigh all of your options. There is space to lean into resistance and determine, is this like my body saying no to this, or is this my fear or my ego telling me I can't do it or whatever? There's a sense of poised readiness. I don't have to be in action all the time, but I'm ready whenever I'm needed. There's a sense of grounded judiciousness and discernment and a willingness to slow down to come to the right decision. This is the state, believe it or not, this is the state that you want to be in whenever you're talking to your partner about something really serious. You want to be in this state. You want to have just enough gas to get your words out and come up with your thoughts and notice your partner and notice your body. But you want to have the brakes on there too, because you have to be very careful with your words. You have to be able to slow down to listen, to really hear what they're saying instead of interpreting it through ego. Like, this is the state for hard repair kind of conversations. Here's how our unintegrated judgment can harm other people. When we should all over others, when our extreme anxiety and panic bleeds into relationships, especially intimate relationships, when we're unable to make decisions in relationships, but generally about anything. Sometimes we need to be able to make a decision, and not making one can have an effect on other people. And when our children learn this state from us through modeling, we also harm ourselves with our unintegrated judgment. When we should all over ourselves, when we're stuck in the overwhelm, the panic, and the extreme anxiety, we're literally stuck in life. When we're so afraid of making the wrong choice that we make no choice, which often means we don't make the choice to do the thing, say the thing, set the boundary, whatever we need to do. And when we feel all resistance as intuitive resistance, when most of it is actually fear-based resistance. If anybody has a question about that, ask me at the end, because I know that might be perking somebody's attention. And finally, our dorsal vagal activation. This is the state of collapse. The primary energy of this state is shame. Grief would also be on here, I think, because it takes a lot of rest to grieve. But we'll talk about shame for tonight. So, when dysregulated, you kind of isolate yourself, frequent short spells of dissociation, boredom, blankness, apathy, zoning out, mindless scrolling, feeling helpless. When that collapse is really big, it's like severe depression, chronic fatigue, dissociation, I can't, shame, shame, shame. When integrated, we actually get the secondary nervous system state of stillness. So that's when we have our safety ventral vagal activation with our dorsal vagal breaks. Those combine to form the state of stillness. So that's an integrated collapse. Peace, presence, mindfulness. Shame also is something that serves to bring us back into integrity. So that's when we feel the natural sense of shame when we do something that we know we shouldn't have done. If we will listen to that shame, it will lead us out of stuckness rather than us becoming stuck in judgment of ourselves. So in relationships, the energy of shame serves to let us know when we're outside our integrity. When we have said or done something that isn't congruent with our character. And this is not the kind of shame that is unfairly put on us. No one is shaming us in this kind of shame. This is a natural feeling that arises when you need to course correct, take responsibility, take accountability, change your behavior. When it's not integrated and not met with awareness, the energy of shame is outside your window of tolerance. And you may be unable to hold that energy without staying completely immobilized or wanting to hide or disappear or go to sleep forever or whatever it is that you're doing that's keeping you so collapsed. When we have unintegrated shame, we live in this sort of state of chronic shame, or guilt. It can end up permeating so many aspects of our lives and our relationships, and it leads to unconscious reactions like isolating ourselves, believing we can't do anything, believing that we're victims. The body actually produces numbing chemicals to conserve energy. And chronically, this will lead to people being in chronic fatigue, being bedridden, being like a couch potato, which further increases the shame. If shame cannot be integrated to allow for deep rest or mobilized with safety to bring peace, then we stay in this stuck state and our window of tolerance stays very small. So here's how we can harm others with our unintegrated shame. We shame other people. We miss out on life with others because of depression, fatigue, self-isolation, and dissociation. When we model this collapse to our kids, when we aren't present in relationships, especially with our kids, and when we are ideating or attempting suicide, definitely harmful to other people. We can also hurt ourselves with our own unintegrated shame when we get so stuck in our shame that we can't find our way out, when we miss out on life because of depression, fatigue, self-isolation, and dissociation. When we have an I can't mindset about life, and when we want to hide or disappear and not be seen. So, what if your anger was integrated to the point that setting boundaries with yourself and others actually deepens your relationship, and you have the mobilization required to use your agency to choose the boundary choose to use your voice, choose to take responsibility. And what if perseverance or anxiety was so integrated to the point that you could stick with the processes of this work, pace yourself, don't have to get it all done at once, trust that you're exactly where you need to be, that you're taking the steps you need to take, and trusting that whatever you need next will be there right when you need it? What if judgment was so integrated to the point that you could discern what is and is not your responsibility? And when something is your responsibility, you willingly take accountability for it. You discern that that is something that you need to do. It's not forced on you. You're not manipulated into it. You've slowed down and you've made that decision for yourself. And what if shame was integrated to the point that it could naturally bring you back into your integrity, not into hiding, not into ghosting, not into checking out on a relationship, but back into your integrity, which is exactly what we need to be in so that we can take responsibility for what is ours, and to be able to be in stillness and mindfulness without believing there's something wrong with us. And anybody who has a perfectionist kid on your bus, you are not going to be perfect at this. You will not get this right 100% of the time, maybe not even 50% of the time, and that's okay. It's a process. Give yourself time. It takes practice. The key is staying aware of that perfectionist part who thinks there's a black and white answer to all of this and maybe feels threatened or resistant to the idea that it's complex. Okay, perfectionists tend to be very black and white, all or nothing. Now we're going to talk about agency and repressed agency. So, agency is a feeling of control over actions and their consequences. It is the idea that people make their own decisions and are responsible for their actions, and agency is purposeful action. So, why do we repress purposeful action? And if you'll remember from the last workshop, repression is when we unconsciously push down, silence, ignore, try to talk ourselves out of what we feel. Like we're doing it, but we don't know that we're doing it. That's what repress means. Suppress means that we are consciously pushing down our emotions. So why do we repress purposeful action? I have a few theories. The first one is our institutionalized education system. We don't get to exercise our autonomy and agency in the public school system. So a bell tells us when to go to a new class. We have zero say in what we study. We don't get to follow our interests and choose what to learn about. We have to ask an adult to use the bathroom. We can only eat at a designated time. If we're tired, we aren't allowed to rest if it's during the school day, et cetera. So there's no choice, there's no agency, there's no autonomy in that system. And most of us grew up in the institutionalized education system. And so we didn't have a lot of practice with getting to exercise our agency to decide what we needed and what we were interested in and when we needed to pee and when we wanted to eat. And I mean, a lot of us are that way in our jobs sometimes. We don't feel like we have a lot of agency or autonomy. If we had controlling, micromanaging helicopter parents, we don't get to exercise our autonomy and agency when we grow up with really controlling parents. I'm not saying that parents with boundaries are controlling. The controlling parent decides for us what we eat, what we wear, the schooling environment, our religious and spiritual beliefs in many homes. We're not given space to explore and take risks. Obviously, there's a lot of nuance here. Like, of course, families are not helicopter parents just because they raise their kids with spiritual beliefs or religious beliefs. But when that is something that is forced on kids and there is no other option, that's when it's drifting into controlling and micromanaging territory. Or like if a kid wants to be a vegan and that is their autonomous choice, fine. But if they don't want to be a vegan or that's not something they're choosing for themselves and the parents are forcing that on them, like, is that micromanaging helicopter controlling? Personally, I think so. If you are that parent, I'm not trying to offend you and I'm totally open to your perspective on that. We are repeating the pattern of choosing attachment over authenticity. So we don't get to exercise our autonomy and agency when we grow up in a home where our autonomy and agency are threatening to our parents and could result in loss of attachment, meaning punishment, timeout, them shaming us, spanking us, etc. The child cannot consciously choose authenticity. The child is wired biologically and emotionally to choose attachment every single time. There's no exception to this. The pattern continues unconsciously into adulthood. So then people pleasing keeps us locked into the unconscious choice of that others approve of instead of the authentic choice we want for themselves. So this is another way that we repress our own agency, is that we're just repeating the same pattern that we chose as children. We just don't know or have awareness that we can choose something else now because we're no longer dependent on the parents for survival the way that we once were. The adaptation is no longer necessary. We do have agency now. Gabor Mate says, when a child is born, the child has two needs. The first need is for attachment, contact, connection, love. Without that, the human child does not survive. Humans are the most dependent on their parents for the longest period of time than any other mammals. Attachment is a huge need to connect, belong, be loved by, and to love. But we have another need as well, which is authenticity. Authenticity is the capacity to know what we feel, to be in touch with our bodies, and to be able to express and manifest who we are in our activities and relationships. What happens to a child when their attachment need is not compatible with the need for authenticity? If I'm authentic, my parents will reject me. If I feel what I feel and express what I feel and insist on my own truth, my parents can't handle it. Parents convey those messages unconsciously all the time, not because they mean to or don't love the child or aren't trying their best, but because they're suppressed, traumatized, or stressed. What does a child do with that? That's a lot. If they give up their attachment for the sake of authenticity, the child loses the relationship on which their life depends. There's no question. What becomes suppressed is our authenticity, our emotions. Then we're 25, 30, 35, 40, and we don't know who we are. We don't know what we feel. We have a strong gut feeling, but we ignore it. At some point, we found out it was too costly for our attachment relationships to be in touch with our gut feelings. It becomes our second nature to suppress our feelings, to lose touch with ourselves, and to suppress our gut feelings. Then we pay the cost later on with addiction, mental illnesses, and any range of physical illnesses. But it all began with this tragic conflict that children should never be confronted with, but are all the time, between attachment on one hand and authenticity on another. So many people are suffering because they want to be themselves, but they're afraid to because they know, or at least they fear, that they're going to lose important attachments in their life. Choosing between attachment and authenticity is impossible for the child. It's not even really a choice. They can't survive without the parent, so attachment it is, by whatever means necessary. They become used to choosing others, pleasing others, serving others, appeasing others, and they don't choose themselves or their authenticity. Their authenticity is repressed. And in some cases, our authenticity, especially as adults, is knowingly suppressed. Impossible situations where our agency was taken away and we never got it back is another reason why we repress agency. Examples of this would be sexual abuse, harassment, rape, being a victim of domestic or physical violence, being kidnapped or trafficked, having parents or caregivers who controlled through abuse, threatened you with harm or harm of someone you loved if you chose for yourself. So let's talk about the difference between suppression and repression. Suppression is the conscious inhibition of unacceptable memories, impulses, or desires or feelings. Repression is unconscious blocking of unpleasant emotions, thoughts, memories, or impulses from conscious awareness. Suppression is when you are consciously stopping yourself from feeling or doing or thinking something. Sometimes suppression looks like having boundaries with yourself. Like, it's not always bad, okay? Sometimes we have urges and things that we want to scream at people that we really don't need to, and we need to hold that boundary with ourselves. Repression is unconsciously stopping yourself from thinking or doing or feeling something. You don't realize that you're doing it, but you're doing it. So suppression often looks like toxic positivity. it looks like you might want to call out a toxic family member, but you refrain because you don't want to cause drama. Like that's an example of suppression. A suppression that's probably not necessary. It's probably needed. But you're afraid of the drama, so you don't call it out. So then the people pleaser kicks in. And suppression, it means that you are intentionally distracting yourself from or avoiding unwanted thoughts or feelings. So that looks like avoidance. People know when they're avoiding something. But repression, on the other hand, is not consciously chosen. It is patterned. An example of repression that we don't understand because it's so patterned is when you're afraid to commit to a partner, but you don't know why. You don't remember or you don't understand the original wound that was caused because you've had to like not deal with that pain for so long because it was too much. Now you're an adult, you're in a relationship, you don't want to commit, or you're afraid to commit, and you can't figure out why. It's usually in some sort of repressed memory, repressed emotion, repressed feelings of abandonment, something like that. Unknown implicit emotional memories, such as a fear of dogs, even though you have no conscious memory of the bite, is a really common repression. Like your original memory of actually being bit by the dog is not something you have, but you have this fear and you don't know why until your mom is like, "Oh yeah, when you were two, you got bit by a dog and it really hurt you. You don't remember it, but that's why you're afraid of dogs." That's an example of repression. So with suppression and repression, we don't have suppressed agency because suppression is conscious, therefore it is a choice. So remember, agency is your ability to take purposeful action. It's the ability to make choices that influence an outcome. You don't knowingly know that you have a choice that can influence an outcome and not take it, hopefully. I like to think that people's repressed or agency is suppressed more than repressed, or repressed more than suppressed. Sorry, tongue twister. A choice to do nothing is still a choice, right? It's still conscious. And agency has been exercised when we suppressed. We chose not to feel it. We chose not to think about it. We chose not to set the boundary or whatever. Like we used our agency and we chose not to do that thing. So it's still a conscious choice. It just may not serve us very well. But with repression, we do have repressed agency because repression is unconscious. It's not really a choice. It's patterned. It's subconscious. It's not on purpose or intentionally. And in agency, we haven't chosen to push that down. We did it without realizing why or even realizing that we did it. Okay, so repressed agency. We have to be aware of our patterns. As we notice our patterns curiously, we can ask questions. What purpose is this serving? I wonder why I do this. Isn't it interesting that I feel the urge to zone out right now? I wonder what I'm not consciously choosing. What's happening in my life that I have not chosen? I wonder what else I could choose. I wonder what else I could try differently. And as you get curious, more awareness will come. So this is how you get yourself out of a stuck place, is by using your agency, noticing where you have the ability to affect change and then taking the action steps to do it. So for example, let's say that you have an intuitive nudge to move your body more. Maybe there's a voice that seems stronger than the intuitive voice, and you notice that voice is loudly saying, "You really should go to the gym. Your ass has gotten so dimply. You really have let yourself go." Okay. Like maybe you've got both. You're like, "I need to go to the gym," like grounded in myself. I know that my body is asking for more movement. And you also have this voice that's like, "Bitch, you need to work out. You're super out of shape. Like, what have you done with yourself? You've let yourself go." If you've never practiced awareness like this before, it might seem weird or hard. Like, asking yourself questions is really going to do anything, but it is. Like, it is. Maybe you had another voice in your head thinking that same thing. Like, it's so weird to just like sit around and ask myself questions about stuff like this. And I'm not a mind reader. I just know that the ego, the unconscious, is very sneaky and it has a lot of great tactics that it uses to stay in the driver's seat of our lives. Anyway, so let's say you stick with it. Let's say you keep feeling the nudge or the urge to go for walks, but you tell yourself you have to work later instead. oh, I can't go for the walk. I need to stay at work longer, or I need to work more. I can't go for the walk. So you notice that a voice in your head says, walking is wasting time. You could finish those emails you've been avoiding in the time it would take you to go for that walk. And then another voice chimes in and is like, no, you know you'll be sore tomorrow if you do. If you go for this walk, you know you're going to be sore. So now you've got two voices in your head that are going against what you intuitively know you want and need, which is to move more. If you're still not aware of these voices, you will ignore the still peaceful voice of your intuition or your consciousness or your higher self, because the voices you're not yet conscious of are the ones that are calling the shots. This is what people refer to as self-sabotage, when they're like, I know I need to do something, but I always end up doing this other thing instead. Like, this is exactly what we're talking about. You're not really actively choosing over and over to ignore the intuitive voice that's drawing you to move your body, unless you actually are, which is a choice. It's more like the voices of you should stay later and work. You should really answer those emails instead of going for this walk or moving your body. You don't have time for this. You know you're going to be sore tomorrow. Don't go for the walk. Those voices get louder than the still small voice of intuition that's like, hey, it would be really good for us. Is this resonating for anybody? Like all these voices that we have and how they override what we know we need and we sabotage over and over and over. So more likely you're just unconsciously going about life, and the voices of your unconscious, which are your ego, your pain body, your inner critic, have you living out these same old stories. And because you're not questioning the voice that says you'll be sore, you're not choosing what the authentic you actually desires, which is for your best and highest good and for the good of all, because we all come from the same source. Like, it is for everyone's best and highest good for you to go for a walk, right? In this example. And whatever you know deep down is in your best and highest good, but you have those voices that just keep coming in and going, oh, you know, you shouldn't do that. Oh, you know how they're going to react. You don't want that reaction. Oh, you know, it's going to hurt their feelings if you do that. You shouldn't do that. Like when those voices are louder and you're not questioning them, you're going to keep banging up against the same shit time after time after time. It's going to get you the same result. And that's insanity. And because you're not questioning the voice that you should work later instead of going for the walk, you're not choosing what the authentic you actually desires, which is for your best and highest good. It's always better to go for the walk than work later. Always. It's never not better. It's always better for you, is what I mean. So our thoughts, including the voices in our heads, are a reflection of the state of our nervous system. So if your nervous system is chronically dysregulated or you're often outside your window of tolerance, those voices are extremely loud and they drown out the voice of the authentic you or the higher self or the intuition or God or whatever you want to call it. It's all the same, in my opinion. So going back to self-responsibility, like stick a pin in that. We're going to come back to it, but we need to revisit self-responsibility. We have a responsibility to ourselves to be in awareness and have a willingness to notice ourselves curiously. Back to agency, we have a responsibility to ourselves to consciously choose when we can. In the movement example, the one I just gave, our bodies are always speaking to us, and desire is one way our bodies speak. If there is a small desire, even a curiosity to move, to go to the gym, to take a yoga class, a Pilates class, to dance, to learn pole, to stretch, or whatever, your body and your soul are speaking to you. Same if there is a small desire or a curiosity about a new breathwork practice or a tarot card deck or an oracle card deck or a book that you pass or a crystal that you find or an outfit or something like that. Like, all of these things are ways that our higher self is speaking to us, and it's through desire. And we're so conditioned to like squelch desire that we call ourselves selfish and then talk ourselves out of it and then sabotage everything. So who knows why our bodies and intuitions whisper up to us, I want to move, I want to dance, I want to eat, or whatever it is that you want. Like, hey, take me for a walk. I want to feel the sun on my face today. Or like the dancing videos Lindsay posts intrigue me. There's something about them that draws me in. I wonder what that would feel like. That's what I felt whenever I watched pole videos for the first time. It was like I was disgusted and ashamed, and at the same time, it was like I can't take my eye off of this. And like I had desire. It was like, oh, I'm interested, I'm intrigued, but I'm also disgusted. Oh my, like it was really, really complex. If you've been in the Feel Without Fear series, I think you know where I'm going with this. Like, this should be pretty predictable by now. How's your relationship with pleasure? We're talking about desire being one way that our bodies, our higher selves, our intuition, our souls speak to us. Our authentic selves speak to us through desire. So we have to revisit pleasure because everything that we desire is almost always in service of pleasure, is it not? Like it almost always is. We want to feel good, and that's okay. But sometimes we have a really fucked up relationship with feeling good. We're not going to stay on the pleasure topic for too long today, but if you are used to consciously suppressing or unconsciously repressing pleasure, you have to become aware of that and the stories you have about it because it takes agency to choose pleasure. It takes purposeful, aligned action to choose pleasure. The example about having an intuitive nudge to move is actually true because it was me. It was me. My body, for a very long time, I was so resistant to it because I had chronic pain. And I had this voice in my head that was like, no, if you do that, it's going to make the pain worse. You know, you're going to be way more sore. You know, you should just finish this work thing instead of doing that. And like, I denied myself months of just going for a nice walk because I let those other voices pile on top of it and drown it out. And then I stopped listening to those other stupid voices and I signed up for a pole class and started going for walks every day. I feel so much better. So I had the conscious desire to learn pole and central movement, but I had a lot of unconscious stories that kept me from signing up. So here's a voice in my head that I had for real. You're 40, babe. It's a little late in life to start that, don't you think? Here's the story underneath the voice. Part of me feels fear or shame about my age and has judgments about older women who own their sensuality and sexuality into late adulthood. Like that was the root of that story. So of course, I'm gonna be like, you're 40, babe. It's a little old to start that, don't you think? And the truth underneath that is there's a part of me that feels weird about aging and judges that older women shouldn't do this or shouldn't do that because of their age. Like it's just a story. It's ridiculous. So my higher self was like, that's silly. I don't believe that shit about age. That doesn't actually feel true for me. I'd rather start owning my sensuality and sexuality now than keep waiting. Plus, it looks really fun. Like, I could hear the voice of my higher self even through the judgy voice that was like, you're 40, bitch. Like, what are you doing? So, here's where I use my agency. Okay. Here's where I took the innermost desire, the intuition of my higher self, the part of me that desired pleasure. Here's what I did with it. I signed up for a full year of School of Stripcraft, which is the online dance school that I'm part of. I took furniture out of my office. See, there's no furniture in here anymore. I took furniture out of my office to make it a small dance studio. I bought cute dance clothes. I showed up for class. I practiced in my free time. I performed solo in a recital. And it says ordering a pole, but I already ordered one. I already use it. It's right there. Isn't she beautiful? So yeah, I mean, I took action after action after action, and all of it aligned with what I wanted to feel, which was I want to feel like that when I move my body. I want to enjoy watching myself when I see videos of myself dancing. I want to be able to like show up to a party or, you know, I don't go to bars very often, but in my fantasy, I want to be able to show up to a bar one day and like some amazing song comes on and I just like bust a move and blow everybody's minds. Like that's where my fantasies went. And so many people would even deny that they have fantasies like that and not even see that as their higher self going, hey, love, here's a desire. Like, there's something here for you that would make you really happy. So, another voice in my head, these are all real examples from me, by the way. Like, I'm pulling these from my own voices in my head. You should move your ass. Jesus Christ, you are so fucking lazy. You used to be in such great shape. You had a dancer's body. Look at you now. Your belly looks like you're 5 months pregnant. You probably need to start with core strength or you won't be able to do anything else. Your core is so weak. Why didn't you stick with any of the exercises the PT gave you? You never stick with anything. What is wrong with you? And you coach people? Jesus fucking Christ. Like, that's the voice in my head. Does anyone have a voice in their head that sounds like that? Sometimes. Deborah, you got one of those? So what's the story under Jen's got that voice? Cool. All right, I'm not alone. So the story underneath that voice is that part of me feels immense shame for how I look and is really full of blame and criticism, while my higher self is nodding her head and is like, yeah, we have big work to do and we need energy and health and strength. You need to support your body. Like, I'm able to feel both. I'm able to feel the overwhelming voice that's like, oh, you fat, lazy, move your butt. Jesus Christ, you really let yourself go. I am able to notice that voice. And at the same time, I can notice that there is this higher self, juicier part of me that's like, babe, you do big work in this world. Like, you need a lot of support. You got to be at your best. You got to be at your best, or you can't hold space for these people the way you do. Like, that's higher self energy. So both are present at the same time. So, my higher self is like, as I said, that voice of self was part of my story along with that critical voice. I was aware of them at the same time. And this will start to happen as you get further along in your work. That curious noticing of multiple voices and conflicting parts and God and self and even spirit guides. Like, I hear spirit guides and shit now. Like, there's lots of, I don't tell my psychiatrist any of this because I don't want to be diagnosed with something else, but like it's all intuitive. It's all coming through like through the channel of my nervous system, right? So how did I use my conscious choice or my agency to affect change in this area of my life? I choose to stop speaking to myself so critically. Like I have to catch myself when I'm in that and be like, nope, we don't talk to ourselves like that. That's not loving. It serves no purpose to be so self-deprecating except to keep me stuck and full of shame. I choose to hire a weightlifting coach, which I did. I joined my local, very small, dumb gym. It's not impressive. It smells like really bad nursing home air freshener. I don't like it in there, but I fucking joined it. I joined my central movement class. I committed to a year. I practiced. I started going for walks. I also stopped weighing myself. And I have decided that my weight is not going to be a focus. I'm happy with whatever the weight is, as long as I feel supported in my body and I feel strong and I feel healthy. I'm not paying attention to the scale anymore. My body clearly desires support, not management, not restriction. So this is a complex topic, and it's often easier for me to explain some of these concepts with real examples than with terms and lots of explanations. So I hope that that peek into my process is helpful. But this is basically my awareness, responsibility, agency process with as much as I'm currently aware of. So the awakenings and awarenesses that I'm having about myself and beyond myself continue to happen. And they're happening really fast. Like, it used to take me weeks or days to like work through something and process and be confronted with my resistance to other perspectives and like let myself be curious about those things and then feel what I felt and all that. And now, unless something really, really big is going on, which is pretty rare, my process through this stuff is like pretty fast. It doesn't take me so long to process or chew on things. It's easier for me to hold perspectives. It really has gotten a lot faster because of all the times I've practiced it. And it's also okay if your process of awareness is different. It really is okay. Our brains work differently. We're different people. That's allowed to happen. Do you guys want a break? We've been going for a while with no break. Do y'all want a break? Give me a thumbs up or a thumbs down. Shake your head. Lenka says yes. Okay, well, Lenka, you got to decide for the group. We will take a break. Let's come back at, let's say, like 43 after. That's about 5 minutes.